This is the first in a four-part series where I want to trace the gospel from Genesis to Revelation, the full story. And it's an attempt to, trace the full story. And I'm aware that the term full gospel has a certain history. I'm not buying into that. I want to encourage you with the glory of the gospel. It's a glorious thing we have. Often it grows sort of dim in our awareness. And I want to prevent us from getting over-focused on one aspect and thereby neglecting others. When you've got the whole, you're safeguarded from that. And I want to see us equipped to share the gospel with ease. Gospel sounds a bit like gossip, doesn't it? Which is very easy. Just imagine being able to talk the gospel of God that easy. So, the gospel, I suggest, can be viewed as having four chapters or four acts. Think of an opera or a stage play. And they'll be coming individually on different Sundays, but that's the way I want to move through it. And the four headings I have for them are creation, fall, redemption, and transformation. And when we have them together, I suggest we have the gospel. So that's the plan for this series. So today I want to examine the gospel of creation. The undiluted good news with power to enlighten, to liberate, and to empower. This chapter of gospel, this first act, as it were, underlies so much, not only in the gospel, but so much in our modern world. It is so connected to the reality that we walk in all the time, and yet it's not often acknowledged and lately ridiculed and disowned. So let's set a context for this. It is about context. Now, all humans seem to have got this worked out. Here's the basic plot. We're born, we live, we die. Is that enough to go on? Is that enough to, as it were, live life, be society? It's not a lot, is it? It's only one step beyond what we learn very early in life, that food goes in here and comes out somewhere below. I mean, these basic human awarenesses aren't enough to live with, to guide us, to be society, to build civilizations. We crave, and I say we, as in all humanity, we crave an adequate frame for our existence, our being. Some reference, something we can tell our story by. There it is, story. There's a market for explanations, models, and understandings. I've met some very intelligent and highly skilled people in recent years, and the really smart ones come to a point where they realized, I don't know how to live. And they go searching, looking for some frame of reference, some teacher, some guru, some book. Because when life speeds up in the fast lane, the risk of crashing is just so real. And so the question forms for this frame, this model: how come there is a world, a universe, life, people, us, me? Tell me that one. How come? And we live in a world where those questions apply, even if it's muted or drowned out. I wonder what would happen in a typical secondary school. We have some teachers here. If the question were asked of students or of teachers, how can we account for our existence? What would happen? You're smiling, Megan. Have you got an answer to that? What would happen?
Blank looks.
Blank looks, yes. Moving right along now. The curriculum, page 5. Let's talk about wallpaper, the colour of a toilet seat, and other important things. You hear what I'm saying? The people of ancient Israel lived in a world where, and think Old Testament now, where it was just like that, in the sense that the question was alive. How come there is a world, a universe, life, people, us, me? Even though they were seen through very different lenses and different language was used and different perceptions, but the question was alive. So it's not new. Getting back here, local, if you were to interview people in Dunedin today and ask, how is it that this world exists as it does, and what is our place in it? I got so excited about this, I thought about standing on the university campus and just with a clipboard asking people, because it's a live question. But if you were to ask that question, that's been around as long as humans have been writing things down, what sort of answers would you get in Dunedin today? Okay, a politically incorrect question. You know, let's go back to asking, can you tell me what time it is? Yeah. I fear that many would, but like Megan said, put this in the too hard basket. Just too difficult. Ignore it. It's irritating. Controversial. It's much easier to argue about the minor issues than the big picture. Since we've been back in New Zealand, we have a radio in our truck. So we begin the day with Morning Report. What a whole lot of crabs in a bucket. People squabbling about minutiae, and there's one or two little stories that are applied to every development. No big picture. It's got the worldview of a postage stamp. But that's the street, isn't it? And I'm not knocking New Zealand here. I'm not saying that. But the question is about origins. So back to Dunedin here, if you're on the street. Apart from theists, those of us who believe in God, and there are various wide variety of theists, of course, of various persuasions, because we relate reality to God. As Paul Tillich said, God is the ground of our being. Love it. In him and we live and move and have our being, as Paul quotes in Athens when he's there. I was thinking, what could I expect to meet? Well, I could meet some Maori mythology and various scientific answers. I don't know if there will be other approaches to this question. Explain. So a mythological approach, which I respect, because I understand myth and its attempt to sort of say something true about reality, and equally scientific approaches in the plural, because there's more than one. So the Maori mythology, you all went to school, you know about Ranganui and Papatuanuku, the sky father and the earth mother, and the battle that the kids had to engage to separate and to create a space. And the myths are typically about going from darkness to light, from nothing to something. So they have a strong sense of creation's gradual process and relate it to the dawn of the day and how humanity needs to live in tune with that. So that's Maori mythology. There's a lot more to it, but globally that's what you might meet if someone were to answer the question. Serious story designed to communicate important things. Neither science nor theology. But alongside that, you might get some hardcore scientific explanation in terms of time, space, and matter. Chris, you're falling asleep already. Time, space, and matter. So when you boil all the faculties down, cosmology, physics, chemistry, biology, or evolution, down to their basic reality, in the materialistic scientific view, you get space, matter, and time. Which means that there's stuff and then accidents happen. That's hardcore, and I'm not saying all scientists would go there. And without God, space, matter, and time are pointed to as the basic or the ultimate reality. Favorite question I love to ask, but usually gets a very blank look, Megan, is, in your view, what is ultimate reality? It's a very important question. Most people run for cover. They're scared of ultimate and they're scared of reality. And I need to say that not every scientist is satisfied with this. So recently in the literature, there's quite a bit of talk about mind with a capital M, which is incredible from the scientific community. In other words, there's recognition that in reality, the deeper we go, the more we learn, the intricacy of the organization, the wonder of what is, there must be a mind there. There is evidence of a mind. So I'm just speculating what I might meet on the streets of Dunedin. So my purpose in that very brief survey is to show that there is a question and the range of answers that we might find to that. The question, how is it the world exists as it does, and what's our place in it? Just a show of hands. Who struggled with this somewhere in their life? That big why, how come question. Kept you awake at night? Had you sitting on rocks during your holidays?
Yeah.
Holidays are good for this. So, now, Israel lived in a time of history where this was alive and kicking. For most of her life, Israel in the Old Testament lived as a little people. Little people. Think New Zealand, think Belgium, think Fiji, Taiwan, with a unique faith. They were the only monotheists in existence. And they lived among big powers, big nations, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia. So you've got to get yourself into that mindset. And so their thoughts, their perceptions were up against and often drowned out or proclaimed over against what the big nations and the big cultures, often far more advanced than their culture, were saying. So just to make this alive, one of the funny things for Barbara and I being international was, in New Zealand, 60s, 70s, 80s, we grew up watching American TV and British TV. So we knew the idiom, we knew the language, we knew the jokes. We arrive in Europe, and the number of times we found ourselves translating between Brits and Americans. Now, we could have a conversation about their culture. We could talk America, we could talk Britain, imperfectly, because we were looking through the lens of media, of Hollywood, of Coronation Street, you know, going back a long way. They couldn't talk about New Zealand, because we come from a little country. We don't have a massive film industry and a broadcasting system, and our stories aren't out there. And when a New Zealand film does make it, boy, it's world famous in New Zealand, isn't it? It happens. So Israel was something like that, in amongst its neighbours. And it struggled and suffered among these bigger powers. Suffering was much bigger than just losing the cricket or the rugby or something like that. You know, they were destroyed, imprisoned, taken off as slaves, and worse. But she had her stories, and her answer, how is it that this world exists as it does, and what's our place in it? Now, at this point, you may know that one of the oldest pieces of literature in existence is a Babylonian creation epic, Enuma Elish, Once on High. Is where the first line starts. And it's a story that people right across the ancient Near East knew. So that whole arc of Egypt through to Persia, it was like world literature. And those who could read, and cuneiform, and the story was taught. This was the Babylonian answer to that question. How is it that the world exists, and what's our place in it? And what this story of the day said about the beginnings of reality was that heaven and earth was the result of a primordial monster being killed by her powerful son. So Tiamat was killed by Marduk. And there's a graphic there because they drew lots of pictures to represent this. And this primeval monster was cut up into pieces, and the pieces is the stuff of the universe and of humanity. And so the blood of this primeval monster is in us, and that accounts for our spiritual nature. So the divine beings, and there were many of them, were immoral types, and humans were created as drudges. The place of humans was to mess about in the mud and send up sweet-smelling smoke for the pleasure of the gods. Now, you may laugh at this, but this is the worldview that the leading power and the shared culture of the ancient Near East had. There was a primeval battle, a monster was cut up. That's the stuff of everything. And out of that spiritual conflagration, something of it landed in us. Appealing? Right? Do you like the idea of being a drudge? Sort of one step down from a drone bee. You're just there to fossick around and mess about, and there's no dignity or grace or beauty, and the best you can do is have a divine barbecue to send smoke up to the heaven. It's an enchanted cosmos full of devious beings with humanity as an afterthought, left to assemble in the scrabble in the dirt and do its best to appease the gods. It's grim. It's dark. Now, I assume you're not being fair in this, and if you want to really get into this, Google, Babylonian creation epic or something like that. It's not good news. Does it bring any hope, encouragement, dignity, or consolation? Any bright prospect in that? You listen with your gut. It's grim, isn't it? Israel realized that. Israel is a little people with an experience of God Most High, listened to these stories, and said, nah. Nah. From her experience of the living God who had met with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who spoke with Moses, who'd rescued them, so I'm putting this after 1400 BC, who rescued them from Egypt. The steadfast love of the Lord never changes, became her anthem. His mercies are new every day. You can't reconcile that with an answer to the question of why is everything like it is? Why are we here? What is it to be human? With this grim saga. So what does Israel do now among the nations? She tells her creation story. And what I love about this, it's a contra. Okay, I hear what you're saying, Babylonians. I hear what the big powers, the big voices, the cultural giants in this region of the world are saying. But it ain't so. Here comes our story. And she tells her creation story in the light of her experience of the God of covenant. So this wasn't just speculation. This is in light of what we have experienced. Here is an account that accounts for why things are the way they are, our place in it, and it's all related to God. Genesis 1 begins in the English, particularly very strongly. In the beginning, God. You can't tell the story any other way. Now, the interesting thing is, the copies or the clay tablets which held these Babylonian epics were discovered mid-late 19th century and deciphered. So it's only the last 150 years that sort of we've known that they were there. Have a great deal in common with Genesis 1. A lot of language, references. The architecture of the story is different, but a lot of the elements in the language and the issues addressed are in common, which is to be expected if you're going to tell a contra story. You tell the story this way, I'll tell the story another way. But recognize that it's talking about the same thing. So let's get to Genesis 1 and 2. As you may know, Genesis has two creation stories. And the first one is in Genesis 1, which Chris read to us today. And it's beautiful, it's majestic, it's structured, it's transcendent. God is awesome, above everything, most high. And the second, God is still wonderful, but he's a potter with his sleeves rolled up, and he takes soil, molds people, breathes into them, really hands-on, really into it. So if you're a do-it-yourselfer, you might go for Genesis 2. If you like transcendent sort of cathedral worship and a sense of God's wonder, Genesis 1. But they're both there. That they're not in conflict. They're telling the story in different ways. But again, to counter the ruling myth that was around in that time. So there's conscious rebuttal and assertion of Israel's faith. You say this, I say such. So Israel was saying, this is the ground of our faith. This is the true God of the heavens who rescued us from Pharaoh. This is the God who placed us in our land. This is the God who keeps faith forever. This myth is about the one true God and not just some idol or fictitious tribal mythology or a political construct as you guys are doing. We're talking about reality here. We're talking about reality we've tasted in history. So what are we told in Genesis 1? What is the good news that Israel declares to her neighbors and the empires of her world? So going to go into sort of just picking out some of the major things that are in that chapter 1. And the first thing she's saying is, all existence is an intentional creation. What is creation, reality, is intended in its existence. It is not an accident. It's not a byproduct. It is willed. All that is framed by the heavens and the earth is willfully spoken into being by a creator. So that's the first counter. It's not an accident, not a byproduct, not an afterthought. Creation is intentional and willed. And that covers everything. So before creation, there was nothing. Seriously deep nothing. Now it's very interesting. Not only Israel realized that, Maori mythology realizes that. Various other mythologies realize that the deep, empty, dark nothing is to be, wow, that was there. And you heard the story. God brooded over this, breathed over that deep nothing, and called into existence reality in all its diversity. Secondly, the creator is a person and stands apart from their creation in independent existence. The creator is there, as it were, one outside the system. Now, this is again something counter to the Babylonians, but many other religions today. We aren't bits of God. God hasn't been sort of invested into his creation. And God is personal. It's a counter to Star Wars, by the way, the Force be with you, no, which is impersonal, but God is a person. Thirdly, creation had a beginning, including time. Physicist, there is a T equals zero point. Time began somewhere. And it's something that through the 20th century, and I don't know if you've read into this, but it's really exciting. 20th century saw cosmologists from the beginning of the century to the end come around to agree with that on the basis of science. There was a beginning. 20th century cosmology and 6th century BC theological reflection meet at the end of last century. Next point, creation is profoundly ordered. It's not a chaos. That's the point. It's an ordered, willful composition, a step-by-step process. Now, here's a big thing to understand. Religions of multiple gods or multiple deities are inherently chaotic because it's a bit like government or politics. Who's in the committee today? Who's calling the shots today? It could be A, B, or C. Israel tells a story. No, there's one God who created it and is consistent and is reliable. Now, one of the things in Genesis 1, just verse 16, just a little illustration of this. In the ancient Near Eastern world, as many parts of the world today, I can tell you, right across Asia, they still think the stars, you know, astrology is still big, and the stars are ruling your life. Israel was aware of this. No. And at the end of verse 16, I'll read verse 16. God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And here it comes, and the stars. It's just a little afterthought. Those little bright twinkly things up there, they're just an afterthought. They're not gods. They're nothing to take seriously. You see, that's the rebuttal. Very subtle, but huge in its implications. So, that's part of the story. And it's actually, in the very, very broad scale of things, a step. It desacralizes the heavens. They're not gods up there. They're just sources of light. Nothing new. Israel was saying that a long time ago. So, secondly, this profoundly ordered. This is why modern science in a Judeo-Christian context is possible and sustainable. If reality, if creation is ordered, you can investigate it. And you know that the realities are constant because there's one steadfast, faithful God who is its author. Again, if there's a committee or if there's a God who makes up his mind afresh every split second called Allah, you can't really investigate because reality is changing all the time. It says the committee or as Allah wills it in that moment. But if it is profoundly ordered and set in place, you can investigate. The implications are huge. So that gives rise to not the first example of science in human history, but the first example of science that didn't fall over after a few centuries because the constancy is solid. So, when we find ourselves in this creation story, there is very good news. Very good news. Because instead of being drudges or biological accidents, humanity is created as the pinnacle of God's creation. Now, this is where it becomes really good news. The stuff I've said so far is sort of encouraging, but a bit subtle in background. But to say that humanity has a peak place in creation and was designed for relationship with the Creator, now that's awesome. That's worth a hallelujah. A new one would come from somewhere.
Okay.
And so humanity alone was made to be God's friend on earth and to collaborate with the Creator in enjoying and caring for creation. John, is that good news? No. So much grace and dignity afforded. No other worldview I know gets anywhere near it. Nowhere. So Psalm 8 may already be coming to your mind. It expresses this as wonder to God. This is Psalm 8 from about verse 3. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them? Yet you have made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. You have given them dominion over the works of your hands and have put all things under their feet. When there is so much that comes against us as humans to rob us of our dignity, to push us down, this, for me, is great news. I'm not going to go too far and say, I was created to be a superstar and have success every day and to have everything my heart's desired. I'm not going to a prosperity or a gospel or anything like that, but I am claiming the gospel here that I was made to be a friend of God. I was made to be a friend of God. Do you ever sing, or have you ever sung here that great kids song? I am a friend of God. I am a friend of God. He calls me friend. We should learn it, Bob. It's a kid's song. I love it. You know, I make it sound like the Muppets, but it's hitting this beautiful gospel truth that's established in Genesis 1 about the grace and the dignity and the honor, and most important, I'm made for friendship with God. So whatever our circumstances may be, and whatever the people you meet, their circumstances, hold this. They, you, I, we are made to be God's friends. So Genesis 2 models this with a different story. Same as it were, message or vision that it's putting across about God forming humanity from the clay, breathing his life in, and blessing Adam with Eve, and God being personally involved. That is so different from you're a bunch of mythical accidents or scientific consequences that took 13 billion years to happen, but you're here now, so we might as well put up with you. Or things like that. So these are just a couple of highlights out of that first chapter of Genesis, and then comes verse 31. God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good. The very is emphatic. If I could imagine the Trinity saying, haven't we done well? And humanity there as the pinnacle of all this. So, those are just a few highlights of the good news in the Genesis accounts of creation. Who's learnt something? No one? Okay, think about it. But it gets even better in Jesus Christ. And so we had the gospel passage today. And this is going to be very short because it's been said already, but John just sort of alludes to this and affirms this in beginning his gospel. So in the opening of his gospel, all what I've said here is related to Jesus Christ, whom John has personally known. And John uses a Greek concept, logos, to say that the rhyme, reason, rationality, the heart and soul of the universe spoken by God was a friend of mine. And the Word, the Logos, became flesh and has recently been living among us. And I saw him. He was magnificent, full of grace. In the beginning was the Word Logos, and the Word Logos was with God, and the Logos Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. Partly why I was moved before when we sang that song, Jesus, what a beautiful name. So much more could be celebrated in this. But for us today, the point is all the good news of God in creation was represented to us in Jesus Christ. He was and is the key to creation at the beginning, in the middle, and in the future. So, that's my attempt at opening up some of the riches in the gospel of creation. It's been all good, isn't it? It's all positive. Next week, fasten your seatbelt, because it's the gospel of the fall. So,